morning. You're listening to Expansion on republicbroadcasting.org, the RBN network. This is Sophia, your host, and my show is always on Fridays. The archives at RBN are a good place to go if you're curious about a lot of different subjects. I have done now, this will be my first interview with Jennifer Lake, who covers with us the disease model, modern disease model, let's call it. In the previous interviews that we did together, Jennifer, who was a nursing student and then started to investigate polio, found herself running through all kinds of tunnels in a rabbit hole that was much bigger and darker than she had ever expected. And in our second show, I think it was, we covered the militarization of medicine, and it really hit me very concretely then that this idea of public health that was established at the beginning of the 1900s was not at all about public health. It wasn't in the interest of the public. It was exactly the opposite. It was to experiment with public health in nefarious ways. And that helped me to see that so many organizations and institutions that are official and carry a term or name of some kind actually are out there doing the opposite of what they claim to be doing and what the public embraces them for ostensibly doing. So Jennifer was possibly the first person to really show me how this worked, and I hope that you will go back and ferret out those interviews that I have done with her in the past on the RBN show archives under the name Expansion and Sophia Smallstorm. I would love to welcome Jennifer back. She has been traveling. She has more to say on the disease model. And are you with us, Jennifer?
I'm here, Sophia.
So how was your summer?
Well, my summer was very, very interesting. I traveled all summer. I took off and got on a plane. I went to Europe and had a lot of time to be settled and catch up on my reading. I took lots of notes. And what I really did was fill in a lot of context to what I've been following. So I feel like the interviews that we did before were long ago and far away. So much more information has come to me, and I've been assimilating notes and things too.
Well, we would love to hear about that. We've got 2 good hours in which to do that and a break coming up right now. You're listening to Expansion on republicbroadcasting.org, the RBN network. This is Sophia, your host. And our guest today is Jennifer Lake, who has been a wanderer for the summer and has done a lot more note-taking and exploration and reading about the modern disease model. Jennifer, you want to bring us up to date on what you have discovered?
Well, I've just been expanding this. I've been looking for background. When I first came on with you, Sophia, I had come to a realization that polio was nothing like we had been told. And so digging into that, what the hunch is that this had been planned for us. And this is something that extended back in time decades before the public became aware of it. So just pulling on that thread took me to a lot of places. It took me into the chemical industry, and it's taken me to question this whole model of medicine that we have in our country, why it's pharmaceutically based, and how the germ theory came to trump what was the more current theory and the very popular theory of the time. And there's really only one explanation for that, and that is that it was very conducive to the developing of a bioweapon. And germ theory really represents that to me. So I've focused my intent on finding these points in time where that might have been possible and why it was possible. So what I can say is that we're beginning to come back full circle now. We have our allopathic medicine model branching out and accepting the previous theory, which is called pleomorphism. And what that means is that microbial life arises from chemistry, that the foundation of life as we know it is based on development out of chemistry. So we have very complicated chemistry going on in the world today. We have something in the neighborhood of 80,000 commercial chemicals in use, and less than a half of 1% of those has ever been tested for safety.
Yes. In fact, I did an interview on vaccines and quoted from a book that covered, I'm trying to think of the name of the book now, I should grab it and read a couple of lines from it, but, oh, The 100-Year Lie. And they, of course, conveniently, I always use the word they, it's a very nebulous word, but we'll just assume these are the people to whom we have to bow and scrape, but they are conveniently blaming a lot of our ills on this Pandora's box of toxic chemicals. And I have said on this show and elsewhere that we are adapting now chemically rather than biologically. We are having to negotiate so many compounds that are so destructive to our cells and our organs and our systems that we've never had to do that before, and we've had to do that in such a short period of time also. So there's no ability to really adapt to this, although we're doing it. This is what you brought up in your shows.
Right. Well, we're adapting. We just don't know what we're adapting into. This is the uncertainty that we face having such, you know, what I'm calling new primordial soup going on. We really are creating that. And looking around in the environment, we see a lot of things changing. We see organisms that either were completely unknown or have taken some kind of, met their own crossroads, and they've altered their structure and their form. Things that were not toxic in the past are toxic now, such as molds and slimes of all different kinds. So we really have a lot to look at as far as what's going on and what's contributing to this. But most essential to that is to understand that chemistry is the foundation of life, and that's a very well-proven track in science. And it's why things work this way. It's part of what makes vaccines such a frightening situation, because, as I said before, a vaccine is a toxic load. And when you take in this new chemistry, and this includes biocompatible chemistry, virus, molds, whatever else is in there, you know, the body has to readjust. It's creating a new environment each time. So I am so convinced that a vaccine is a very dangerous bioweapon. It plays percentages with people's lives. There will always be losers in this equation. There will guaranteed be people who will have adverse reactions to that. And on the accountability scale, this is a dangerous weapon, and we should not be doing this. My feeling is that at best, this is a life-saving measure for people. And we know with the emergency...
Wait, let me interrupt you.
Sure.
You're saying we should not be doing this, and this is a life... I don't understand all those thises.
Well, looking at allowing public medicine to be the distribution of vaccines.
Well, sure. We should not be vaccinating is what you're saying.
Yeah.
I also wanted to just go back to something you said, which is a little bit, it hit me again in a different context. I had been saying that we are adapting chemically to things, but you brought up the idea that we're adapting ourselves. We ourselves are adapting into something. We're morphing.
Yes.
Because of this prevalence of chemicals, and now we have other things too. We have, I don't even know what category to place it in, but I think we're going to get into it in this interview, the whole Morgellons universe.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not exactly a chemical. That's another ordering form that is entering our bodies, another organizational platform.
Right.
Nanotechnological platform.
Right.
So this is, I think people are not realizing. In fact, I have to say I'm being bad. I'm using a blur or smudge tool right now.
Uh-huh.
And I'm realizing that if you use a tool like this, you're blurring two colors, let's just say black and white. And unless you're very careful about spreading in one direction only, you're getting a crossing over of the white into the black. And that's exactly what's happening in biology with us today. You can't keep the barrier intact between the human being and what is around him or her. You know, it's a permeable barrier.
Sure, that's fundamental, I think. One of the things I've really been looking at a lot are the origin of life theories and trying to really catch up on that and get myself well-grounded in what's current and what people are talking about. Interesting ideas out there. There is something called the life from clay theory, and the life from clay is chemically based organisms that develop out of mineral structures. So I know that we've had some confusion in the past talking about viruses, whether that was organic or inorganic. The line is very blurred. What dawns on me is that it's really all gray area. So when we're talking about this, they become distinctive in their application. Organic chemistry is more about how it's applied than actually what it is. And one of the interesting scientists that I came across as a geologist, his name is Robert L. Folk, and he has been a professor in Texas at the University of Texas, and he discovered what he dubbed nanobes. So we're getting into nanotechnology now, and he was...
What does he call them?
Nanobes.
N-A-N-O-B-E-S?
Right.
Okay, and what are they?
And he also spells it with a double N because he says in geology that's how they spell it. That's a consistent form of that word. So it can be spelled either way with two N's or one. But what he observed looking at clay, he was in volcanic clay structure, and he found what he believes are the smallest and most ancient forms of life. Now he's calling them life. That's certainly contentious. Depends on your point of view, I guess. He's very enthusiastic about that. But he first introduced these ideas back in the early 90s, I think. He's been looking at this for a long time. But in the 90s, he brought it to the attention of a scientific organization that takes on a lot of defense contracts. And it's called SPIE, S-P-I-E. And they had a big conference in San Diego. They are initially a California-based organization. But I went looking at their website, and they're doing some pretty fascinating stuff. They are making real a lot of these technologies that have just been science fiction to us over time.
Well, where is it all going?
Well, it's just going into more and more technologies. It's becoming kind of, a workable thing now to mix biology into this whole equation. Some of the solar technology they have now is nanotechnology based. They're creating chemical organisms, so to speak.
And of course they don't know what they're doing, or they do, and we don't know where it's going to end up. But anyway, I hear our break music coming, and so we will be back in another 3 minutes.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Listening to Expansion on republicbroadcasting.org, the RBN network. This is Sophia, your host, and I'm back today with Jennifer Lake, with whom I have done 3 interviews in the past about the modern disease model. So, Jennifer, we were ambling around discussing how introduction is being made of more chemicals and more, would you call it, could we say artificial forms into our biology, ecology, environment, bodies, and so forth, and we're adapting, I would have to say, toward this, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, as long as we're here, we'll be adapting towards it. I think the imperative of life is to put everything into use in one way or another. So our biology is geared to finding a use for this, and chemistry does what chemistry does. Given the right set of circumstances, it makes compounds, and then it begins to just integrate whatever is in the environment, and then life forms do arise out of this. So much of what I think we can consider virus has developed out of this, and the complexity of virus these days just amazing. More and more things are being discovered. And I use that term in quotes when I mean that, because they're just appearing. This is an idea called spontaneous generation. It's an old idea. The Greeks knew about this. They had based their ideas on observations that they were able to make at the time. We have a much more sophisticated understanding with microscopes, the very powerful kinds of microscopes that we have now, where we're seeing this in motion. And that's what Robert Fulk saw when he did his work. He was studying this with electron microscopes, and he actually saw these entities forming. And he found them all in mineral materials. And when you look at the images that he's got on his website, and there's a lot of websites about this, they look just like virus to our eyes.
Now, can you spell his name?
Yes. Folk is F-O-L-K.
Okay. F-O-L-K, and his first name?
Robert.
So people can Google that. Now, I noticed that in Michael Moore's endorsement letter for Barack Obama, he was hailing the return of science into our lives. And that didn't bode well for me, because that is an embracing of all that is technological, and all that is technological isn't always what's good for us. So it seemed to me that this was setting the stage for modernism, you know, in contrast with the old-fashioned, antiquated views of, quote-unquote, those bad Republicans. Now we have these liberal Democrats who are ready to shoot forward, get this country on track again with the help of technology and, of course, nanotechnology.
Well, science is the next religion.
That's it, too, yes.
Yeah. And it's really functioned as a religion all the time. You know, it's created its dogma, it's suppressed all the heretics, and it's just carried forward. And, you know, I think in our first interview together, you asked me if if I could define science, or that we needed to define science. And it's still something I'm not sure I can do, but the more I dig into this, the more I think that it really is the practice of the religion of gnosis. And the word gnosis itself means knowledge. So science certainly is that practice of knowledge. So it's not a stretch to apply more of a religious connotation to this than actually a technical one. Because science does at will, according to either politics or funding, determine what direction it's going to take. And that's, you know, that's a hierarchy religious type of establishment.
Well, I suppose you could say that societal science does that. There are people who, I assume, do research on their own. There is a new post on aboutthesky.com called A Researcher's Story. That information comes from arizonaskywatch.com. And this is more of the examination under microscope of the self-replicating Morgellons colonies. I don't know that it's fair to call them Morgellons colonies, but that's kind of the moniker that everyone has given them. But evidently there are elements that we are absorbing because they are microscopic. They pass through our natural barriers, cilia and skin, for instance, and they take up residence in our bodies, elude our immune systems, and then they start colonizing. And Clifford Carnicom, as well as this I guess he's relatively unnamed, this researcher. He calls himself Blue. He has discovered, here are break music, so everyone's going to have to wait till we get to the other side of the break for what he's discovered.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Listening to Expansion on RepublicBroadcasting.org, the RBN Network. This is Sophia, your host, and my guest today is Jennifer Lake. We're picking up with her after a summer of continued research that Jennifer has been doing, and we were just mentioning, or I was, the researcher story from Arizona. I have pulled up the site now. It can be seen on ArizonaSkyWatch.com. and also on aboutthesky.com. And I'm going to read some of what this person has discovered. So he took his own, I guess you could say, samples from his blood, his skin, and started colonizing and looking at this under a microscope. I'm trying to figure out how exactly he colonized this. But regardless, the whole thing is explained. It's a very long piece. I'm going to just read for a sensation here what was growing in his jars. The first thing I noticed was a small tapeworm-looking thing I called Fred. It began as a tan speck in the bottom of my jar and assembled itself quite quickly in about 2 weeks from the size of a pinhead to its current size of about 1.25 inches long. I began spending hours every night and every weekend on the microscope looking at these bizarre growths, no visible biology as we know it whatsoever. In the same jar occupied by Fred, a few dozen Morgellons fibers had clumped together, and at one time, Fred got tangled in them pretty good. Much to my amazement, Fred slowly freed himself from this mess while I watched for about 3 to 5 days. The fibers were accommodating the effort by moving out of the way. To this day, I can't get them to tangle up. So here's the thing. These are intelligent forms that know how not to limit themselves, and they apparently create colonies. Clifford Carnicom has shown this also. They throw filaments from one colony to the next. So they're actually like sending out lines to one another.
Like neurons.
Exactly. And this becomes a a web-like network in our own bodies. Mm-hmm. And some of these are crystalline in nature. Some are, it seems that they're polymers, and they're artificial growths altogether. Overall, they're fungi. So there's a lot of stuff. And the question he asks, which is a very good question, if this is visible at not such a huge magnification, for instance, I'm looking at a mucus sample at 100 times magnification, and there's this thing on it that looks like a burr, and the burr has spidery thing. I can only say thing. What else? We don't have the language for this,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Right.
We have one word for snowflake. That's it. But so there's all this growth, and we are seeing it if we choose to put our own skin cells under a microscope. But what about lab techs? What about people who are paid to look at blood? What do they see? And do they say nothing about it? How is the stuff in the blood explained to them? I have gone for blood work, and the list is long when they print it out. Everything. All these, they're usually CMV or whatever, MVC, these initials. And what, how do they account for this stuff that grows in the blood or that appears in the blood? That's what I'd like to know.
Well, you know, one of the things that I learned in looking at the origin of life science is the way they explain it, that we are about 10% human cells and we are 90% microbes. We are composed of microbes. This is the main part of our substance, far and away, is microbial things, bacteria, fungi, all of that. So the fact is we should be crawling with things that look like life and organisms. This is what we are.
Right, but are these elements not distinguishable from microbes? See, he says here, nanotech is designed to mimic the things that man has discovered about how nature works and assembles itself.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess if you really didn't know what was nanotechnological and what was organic, you wouldn't notice. You would say, okay, so my slide sample is swimming with microbes, and I'm just looking for X, Y, and Z.
Right. Well, I think we should just toss the idea of organic and inorganic out the window.
Why is that?
I just don't think we need to make these distinctions. We're looking at chemistry as a whole. And right now, as we know, we've got this, you know, huge input of all kinds of different chemicals going on. So it just makes confusion to try to separate things into the black category and the white category. You know, as you were saying earlier, we're in the blur space here. Everything's gray matter to us.
Right, and gray is new. That's what has to be understood, that we came from black and white, but now we live in gray, and gray is not black and it's not white. It's brand new.
Well, I don't know about that. I think maybe it's always been gray matter. I think that the whole point of germ theory was to make things seem very absolute when in fact they are not. And the competing theory called polymorphism or pleomorphism has always talked about transitional forms. And this is the argument now, and this is where we're behind if we don't really grasp onto this concept, that life forms change. They go through evolutionary stages also, and they have all these transitional forms that they change from a virus to a bacteria to a fungi, and then depending on whether or not they get supported by their environment, they can also change back. And when I brought in the whole idea of radiation as being just a big crapshoot in this whole mix, because it slices and splices, it keeps changing this arrangement, these natural arrangements that arise. It keeps reshuffling them and causing them to become something different. So we are in a kaleidoscope that is changing.
Well, I still don't understand why we have to throw out the terms organic and inorganic. I mean, I'm looking at these slides, and there are all kinds of things that don't look. I'm not trained, of course, but the description of them is very odd, and they don't look
right.
like they belong.
I think in terms of concepts, we use organic to consider that this is a building block in biological life. And so we sort of limit the idea of organic to that. It has to belong to some kind of a biological category for us to call it organic.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look into nanobes and what Folk has discovered as a geologist, he's calling what he's found life forms. And he says they're the most ancient life forms on Earth. So we may disagree with him because it doesn't fit our normal understanding of biological life, but they may be the foundation of biological life.
I see what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
If you go down to the very deep originating root levels, it may not be what we think it is, what we've always thought it was from looking at higher levels.
Right. So we're confusing ourselves in trying to make these separations. In a sense, they don't really exist. We're looking at chemistry, and there's chemistry that enables biological life, and then there's chemistry that we don't normally think of as doing that, and we call all of that inorganic. So what the alchemists were doing, and these experiments have been repeated through time, is they've taken our atmospheric gases and paced them through the process of what the old alchemists did, which is they heat it and condense it and heat it and condense it, and they've been able to precipitate amino acids from doing that, just using the four basic gases of our atmosphere. So this is definitely organic chemistry, and the salts and the things and all these halogen chemicals that we get from the sea primarily, this is organic chemistry, and this contributes to the basis of our biology.
Well, now let me ask you, since you went to Europe and you spent some time there, and you had leisure time, I assume you were not just sightseeing.
Mm-mm.
What did you notice about Europe that is the same or different from the U.S. in terms of, let's start with chemtrails, our favorite subject here.
Oh, my goodness. Well, the chemtrails were amazing there. They actually, at the time I was there, they were the worst chemtrails that I've ever seen. I was surprised. I was not expecting to see so many chemtrails there. I saw the huge prismatic effects, you know, the rainbow colors, and they were bright and intense. And I was just spellbound because I had not seen that before any place but just photographs.
And what country were you in?
I spent most of my time in France.
And what were the French people doing? Were they talking about this? Were they noticing it? Did they care? Were they just like Americans?
Well, first of all, I have to tell you that my French is not very good, so I wasn't able to get a lot across as far as discussing some of these issues with people on the street. But there certainly is an awareness that this is going on.
There is an awareness?
There is an awareness that it's going on, and I think for most of the people who experience this as a reality are people who garden, have farms, have raised animals. They see it because, you know, they're earthy people and they're in the soil and they see changes. They see changes in their plants, changes in the health of the animals that they care for.
So these are deleterious changes.
Yes.
Plants are dying.
Yes.
And you were able to get this information from certain people. I'll tell you, when you see a chemtrail in France next, you point up and you say, qu'est-ce que c'est?
Yeah.
Means, what's this or what's that?
Okay, I'll put that in my French phrase.
But then you have to be prepared. Nuage is cloud in French.
Uh-huh. What is it?
Nuage. N-U-A-G-E.
Okay.
And you have to say that's not a nuage.
Uh-huh. C'est nuage pas.
Ce n'est pas.
Okay. Yeah,
it's
not clouds.
Yes.
Right, the clouds and not clouds. What was interesting was that I had so many flights involved in these travels. I took 9 separate flights to get there and home again. And at some points, I was flying right up into the chemtrails, cutting right through them, and took pictures out the window of the plane. That was fun. I enjoyed doing that. I thought, well, I hope they come out well. I still haven't seen them because I used film, and they're not developed. But coming back, there was a point where I was reaching the east coast of the United States, and there was a sister plane that looked just like the passenger plane that I was in, and it was laying down just the thickest, brownest, scariest-looking chemtrail that I had ever seen. And, you know, my heart really sank because I felt like the plane I was riding in must be doing the same thing, and we're putting down a nice double stripe in the sky. And coming from that vantage point, being up there actually on that level with them and seeing how much of this was coming out, probably a third of the planes that I was able to see that we passed were also laying in chemtrails. And you can't see the ground anymore. It had been a long time since I'd been on a plane. And
you can't see the ground means that there is a white veil.
There's a veil, and it has a bluish cast to it, and you know you can make out very large structures, but you can't see them anymore with fine edges. You really can hardly see as a passenger in a plane.
No, you can't see the earth. You can't see. I mean, I remember flying back from Mexico to New York once, and I was just amazed. I understood what a tiny speck in the universe I was, just being able to be in a plane and looking down and seeing, you could almost see trails, you know, through the mountains, and you could imagine people migrating across continents, and it was really glorious to be up in a plane because you had this vantage point that was extraordinary, and you don't get that frequently. I suppose business travelers do this all the time, and they don't even look out the window, but I do. I always get a window seat. And then the last couple of years, flying has been a whole different experience. You ascend into through the white. You get into what I call the blue-black clear sky because you're up above that demarcation line. And the demarcation line is gunky, yellow, white, gross stuff. And you look through it at the earth, and you can barely see anything.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, is it's just, as you say, your heart sinks when you see that. And you think, is there a way to recover this? And here in San Diego, they didn't spray for a couple of months this summer, sprayed very sparingly.
You mean I missed all that, huh?
They're saving their materials, maybe the fact that these polymers trap ambient moisture and there isn't a lot of moisture in the American Southwest during the summer, it's not worth spraying. And this is just my two-bit analysis. But they will continue. They've already started October, November, December. They'll lay it on thick here. And they do absolutely stripe the central United States, the South, and the East Coast all summer long. And I get reports from people about that. But I have put up a new page on aboutthesky.com, and it is called Media Tricks. And there I have included 3 images. The first is a beautiful Saks Fifth Avenue advertisement. And it shows a model, and she is so languidly, casually resting against this low, I guess it's a ledge in a room, and above her on the ledge is propped a framed picture. And guess what the picture is? It's a landscape with chemtrails.
Really?
Oh, yes. And it is beautiful. This whole photograph is absolutely exquisite in its composition, the color, everything. Even the mood it exudes is very graceful and serene. And yet, the image is a horrendously diabolical kind of concept, that of chemtrails. They're supposed to be in serenity with chemtrails. All right, so here's our break music. I'll be back in 3 minutes with Jennifer Lake. Listening to Expansion on republicbroadcasting.org, the RBN network. This is Sophia, your host, and I'm catching up today with Jennifer Lake, our guest, who has returned from Europe and was giving us a report in this last half hour or so about chemtrails in Europe. And I have been telling our listeners about a new page I put up on aboutthesky.com called Media Tricks. I described the first image on that page, the Saks Fifth Avenue fashion ad featuring a framed picture of chemtrails. The second image that I put up came actually to the world last year. It is a billboard owned by our buddies Clear Channel. And this billboard apparently was in Kansas, and it shows a cityscape, it looks like, with I don't even know how many chemtrails. I'll try to count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 9 big fat ones, and then innumerable little skinny ones and some of the spread out stuff. They're all like unfurling. They look like, well, here's the caption on the billboard, okay? Are you ready? What is a birthday without a few decorative streamers?
Oh, my gosh, I can't believe it.
Yeah, these are streamers. Contrails are like friendly birthday streamers.
Wow.
And the company that has created this giant advertisement is called Spirit AeroSystems.
Hmm.
And you can Google it. And in fact, some of us wrote to the CEO and the marketing head at Spirit AeroSystems last year. One friend of mine called up and asked to know what the meaning of this billboard was. And he was pronounced a troublemaker. And Spirit AeroSystems, I think it was their marketing department, hung up on him. All right.
Well, you know, as far as getting accountability, I mean, that's really what I've been pursuing, too, and going back and trying to get a handle on what our first bioweapons have been as far as diseases go. I think polio is that thing. You know, polio is a nerve agent. The disease of polio is a brain infection. They noticed that it caused the neurons in the brain to disintegrate, actually become chaotic tangles and thinned out and broken threads in the brainstem. And because it's the smallest of the virus, it's been studied and it's been used. And even today, they're using poliovirus for therapy. So everything that's being sprayed is potentially an inoculation. They were very good at learning how to do this back in the 30s. They had made aerosols out of vaccine. So chemtrails are just a big inoculation from the sky.
Well, by definition, isn't inoculation something that is injected into us?
No, inoculation is something that's ingested.
I see.
Either it's put into your bloodstream by way of a needle or you breathe it in. But, you know, the Sabin polio vaccine, for example, that was something you took in your mouth. Didn't need an injection for that. And that was just as much an inoculation as anything else. So even our food is an inoculation. So if they can genetically modify foods to produce vaccines, you're getting your inoculation through your food. But just in case you know that and you're growing your own, they're going to inoculate us all by way of the sky.
Well, we are concluding our first hour of this lovely information, and we will pick up with the second.